Thank you for having me.
So, Adam, tell our audience where you grew up and a little bit about your early years.
Sure. I grew up in a town in Westchester County called Harrison. So in Harrison, New York. I have two older sisters, and the age gap is a little, you know, big between my siblings and I. My middle sister, her and I are 6 years apart, and my oldest sister and I are 9 years apart. My family, my parents both worked. They were hard workers. You know, they both worked in, my dad worked in, for a bank, and my mom worked in pharmaceuticals. So at a young age, I think that I understood that, my parents, you know, they had a lot of work ethic, and they wanted that for their children. And, I think I just at an early age, I think, my sisters were doing well in school and doing extracurricular activities. And I felt like that I needed to had big shoes to fill in a way at a young age.
Right. So growing up, were mom and dad at home a lot, or were they, because they're working, they were absent most of the time?
I remember that my mom did a lot for the kids, you know. Well, I guess I could only speak for myself, but I know that my mom was picking me up from school. My dad would take me to school, and then he would go to the train station and go to work, and my mom would pick me up at school, or, you know, she would meet me at the house when I got off school and she got off work. And then I remember, you know, my mom was a big advocate for having dinners together as a family. But, you know, we all had different schedules, and my siblings having a different age gap than me. And, you know, by the time I was like an early teenager, one of my sisters was already in college. And so it was a little interesting dynamic with the family.
And growing up, how is that relationship now? Are you find yourself closer with your sisters now?
I think in recent time, yes. Our relationship has improved for different reasons, whether you could say that it's because, you know, we've all just gotten older and a little bit more mature. I think there have been circumstances with our family that has brought us together. And, you know, I think, and another reason I just think about the type of person, I guess, once again, like speaking for myself, you know, growing up, I was an angry, I was very angry and towards my family, for a lot of reasons, didn't make a lot of sense, but I made sense to me at the time, and I justified my anger, which I've learned now is a killer for me. You know, I can't really afford to have that, because it hurts me more than anyone else. And it definitely hurts the people around me. Yeah.
At what age did you start to feel that kind of anger or resentment?
I remember at a young age. I think that it went a little bit hand in hand with that. My family was, everybody wanted attention, right? So I think that navigating that with my parents and my siblings, and my parents' relationship with my siblings, I think I was jealous at a young age, or that I just wanted the attention. And, you know, my parents were trying to be the best parents they could, and, you know, divide the attention between the three of us. But, you know, I guess that's the part that's like that self-centeredness that may have been, you know, in my life before, you know, certain substances. It was definitely evident.
When did you first start drinking?
I started drinking. It was mainly, socially, you know, like a lot of people. I always think about, using marijuana, 'cause that, you know, I started smoking weed really was like my first love before, the alcohol came into play.
How old were you?
I always tell people I was 14. I might've been 13. I remember it was like the summer of going into high school. So I was about to go into eighth grade and be a freshman. And I tried it for the first time with some of my buddies and I was off to the races. You know, that it immediately hit me with isolation and, you know, getting high by myself and at 14. And then, but the drinking was something that I did with friends, you know, once high school parties started to kick off and, you know, on Friday or Saturday, you know, we would go to somebody's house and have a house party. And, you know, that was really, I was thinking about my, you know, the beginning of my drinking while I was driving up here. And, you know, I also really, whether it was like the sports that I love to play and I liked to be competitive. So, drinking games became, you know, something that I really enjoyed. It was just, you know, playing beer pong or some of my friends, we would play with quarters and, you know, I liked the competitive aspect and I liked the feeling that these, you know, the substances gave me, of course.
What I know, liking the feeling is something everybody who's done this, you know, at least the way it started out is great, but what did it do for you in a social context?
It really, it got me out of myself. I think whether it was a lot of insecurity growing up, you know, that started in school, feeling less than my peers, and that I kind of bounced around from different friend groups. But when we would, you know, party together, that was something that I could do to make myself feel like that I was, you know, fitting in, or that I was, that I wasn't, whatever the nonsense I would tell in my head, that, you know, I'm these negative things, whether I'm a loser or an idiot. But when I put the substances in my body,
they went away,
you know, it went away. It quieted those voices and I was cool. I could, you know, fit in.
Did there come a time in, high school where it accelerated, you know, in any meaningful way?
The substances?
Yeah. Substances or drinking or drugging?
Yeah. I know for a fact that, like, I took over this identity of that I was the person that could, that did drugs and that, you know, smoked a lot of weed and I was a pothead and people knew, you know, that I was having, I just liked the persona that it gave, you know, my peers, that the type of person I like, that it gave me a little bit of an edge and
an identity that made you more to stand out, or maybe gave you some kind of more self-esteem.
Yeah, definitely. It's, I really think about, you know, time in college when I think about when it really escalated, because in high school, it was smoking weed every day, a lot of the time by myself, drinking and partying on weekends, and drinking with like some of my guy friends, you know, playing drinking games. But then something happened in college where, like with many, you know, young adults, is your parents are, you know, you're no longer with your parents and you're on your own and you can kind of do whatever you want. And I had a fake ID and whatever, all of that stuff that comes with that.
And so you went away to college, no controls. And it escalated. Any events that occurred during that time that were kind of markers of like, what the hell am I doing?
A little bit. I think I wanted to, once again, once I got to college, I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to have a good time. And immediately, you know, I went to a big school, a party school, and I went to Syracuse. And you know, that's what people did. You know, I wanted to join a fraternity and, you know, watch, you know, college hoops.
Are there any non-party schools?
Yeah, probably not. I mean, so one thing that has been made pretty clear to me is that, you know, it doesn't matter where you went. It's wherever you go, you bring yourself with you.
Right. So in college, no major events, like no DWIs or you know, suspensions or anything like that, just accelerated use.
No. Okay. I'm sorry. So yeah, there was some of that. No DUIs, but I was hospitalized a couple times for my drinking. Like, one memory always comes to mind when I was, you know, it was a bad night for me, you know, and I woke up and I was strapped down to a gurney in a hospital and I'm yelling at the nurses and they're threatening to get the police involved. And it was just like, I have like the fragments of memories of that night are just like, you know, and just make me feel I want to use the word cringe, but yeah, it makes me it's hard to believe that I acted that way. And
and I'm sure that led to the fact that you turned everything around at that point.
No, definitely not. No, I think I left the hospital and I walked back to my apartment and I just, did the same thing. I was like, I need to make myself feel better. And that instant gratification, I was like, I need a drug. I need a drink.
How old are you at this point? 21?
Around there. I'm probably a little younger. I want to say 20, maybe 19.
You graduated?
I graduated. I did an extra year college. I've heard referred to as a victory lap, the fifth year. But that's actually when the the worst. That's when it really started to get evident that this is a problem around that fifth year time. My first 4 years of college, it was a problem. Oh, and then you mentioned like probation. Like throughout my college career, I couldn't get my shit together in terms of my academics. Despite all the support around me, I had professors that knew this was a red flag and an academic advisor, and I would get to the point where I was going to get kicked out of school, and then I would get a GPA like just high enough to balance it out. And it was just this cycle of about a flunk and then barely squeaking by. But then in that fifth year, I don't know what happened, but I really fell apart. Like I was on the verge of getting kicked out. I didn't care
anymore. Did you have enough credits or did you need the fifth year to get enough credits?
I needed the fifth year to get enough credits.
Did you get them?
What happened was I went to treatment for the first time.
In your fifth year of college?
In my fifth year of college, I went to the treatment for the first time. I was isolating once again, like I was for a lot of my life at this point. But this time, because all my friends had graduated, it was a lot of just like staying in my apartment and drinking and drugging, and I was cutting class, and my academic advisor, who knew me very well up to this point, was like, what's going on? And he was contacting my parents, and I heard a knock at my door. And because I had been ignoring my parents' calls, I was, they were calling me. I was sending it to voicemail. And then I heard a knock on my door, and it was my dad. And he had drove 4 hours unbeknownst to me to let me, say what's going on. And I had to come clean at that moment. And that was the first time that I admitted I had a problem and went to treatment. But, I still wasn't ready. But that's more to my story a little bit.
So you went to treatment for 30 days?
I went to treatment, for 30 days. I was probably in detox for 4 or 5 days. At the time, they wanted me to go to a sober house. And I told them that I couldn't do that, that I had to go back to school and finish and get my degree. And, that was a mistake. I wish I had listened to the professionals then, because even though they had my best interest in mind, I couldn't see that at the time. It was all about, I know what I'm doing, I'm fine attitude. And so that's a little bit. So I ended up going back, even though I relapsed, and I got by it once again. I had to do some pretty embarrassing things, like beg my professor to just give me a D. I can't come back here. If you fail me, I'm gonna have to come back for another semester. I had friends and, helping me with courses and to just get me by.
I might have done himself a favor giving you a D.
Yeah.
Get rid of you.
That's right. No, exactly. I think that he was like, I'm sick of this kid. He doesn't care. I know, I thought it was slick. I was like, I forgot. I told him some probably lie. So I was being dishonest. I was telling him, I didn't do well because this, and my dog ate my homework or something stupid. And he he was just like, he probably knew that something was up. And, but honestly, maybe I owe that guy a thank you, because maybe if things would have taken longer or something, if he had failed me, I would have went back to Syracuse, and
who knows
what could happen.
So you leave Syracuse. Where do you go then?
I leave Syracuse. I graduate. It was around that time when I was having some difficult stuff with my family. It was around that time when, some diagnoses were happening, and my mom was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And I I kind of just, it was a weird time in my life. I just finished college and I was unemployed because I didn't have a job lined up. I never really thought about my future when I was at college. I always was just, I'm going to get by, you know, I'm going to do the best I can. And then, while there's a lot of power in doing the best I can, I just didn't really have sight into the future or didn't really care. So around that time, you know, my mom's condition was getting worse and, you know, I had come clean that, you know, I was, you know, even though going to rehab for the first time, I was no longer sober.
What were your drug of choice? Drinking and pot?
In college.
At this stage though.
At that stage, it was alcohol, pot, and then benzos. I was taking a lot of Xanax.
Right.
There was also, you know, I was really into psychedelics and I liked,
anything really,
anything I could get my hands on. I stayed away from like painkillers and heroin, honestly, because I knew that I kind of had a feeling, like, given my history with some alcohol and weed, that if I tried it, I would have been hooked. So that, for some reason, you know, that steered me away, luckily.
Mom gets sick, and how long did she have treatment for?
She had treatment for it was a little under 2 years, so about 20 months.
And then she passed away.
What
was that like?
It was really, really tough for not only myself and my family. I think about it was tough because I was 23 years old when she passed away. So I was still in college at that time when me and my family were given the diagnosis that she had this illness. And, I went back to just numbing, the drugs and the alcohol. It was already my best friend. It was the only thing that I knew, because it kind of, quieted the voice going on that, you know, and the shame and the guilt. And I still deal, you know, with that stuff. I'd be lying if I said I didn't. I think about how I used to, you know, my addiction, like I said in the beginning of the podcast about, I was an angry person growing up. And unfortunately, my mom had suffered a lot of the wrath of myself and us, like when those early years of my addiction, high school, and when it first started to pick up and I was isolating and I would, you know, get high by myself and I would get caught because I wasn't very slick, and I would just get so angry and I would, you know, be really, I was a vicious person towards I wasn't physical, but verbal and emotional. It was heartbreaking. You know, my mom would get upset and, you know, I just didn't have a care in the world at the time. You know, I was so mad at everybody else and myself that, frankly, like, I just didn't, you know, I hate to say it, but like, I didn't want to, you know, I was like, I always think that I had some passive aggressive suicidal ideation going on back then. I never had a plan, but I did, you know, I just hated myself. I hated everything around. I hated the hand of cards that I was being dealt. So that was a little bit about that time in my life. It was a lot of, it was overwhelming.
Somehow Adam bounces. How the hell did you do that? Because there are people listening right now who have no idea how to get out of where they are, which is right where you were. So I want you to try your best to talk about how it is you went from that point to being a resilient person who takes care of himself and is able to inspire other people.
Yeah, it's been a journey. It's been a lot of ups and downs and learning and growth. And, but I think at that time, one thing that was important for me to, at that time, like when I first made the decision to go back to treatment again, because there was a time between when I went to treatment for the first time and then when I went to treatment this time around where I tried again, but I just didn't have the support. So I had a little bit of experience like trying to get sober, and I knew what didn't work because, you know, I ended up relapsing. That was important, because the first, like, I would justify using other substances. Like, I have terrible nights and I end up in the hospital, or, you know, doing things, dangerous things behind the wheel when I'm under the influence of alcohol and, you know, using benzos, like that stuff. But maybe I could just, you know, smoke weed, and I could just, you know, be smoke weed and not drink. But I learned through my experience that I couldn't do that, because once I have that one fix, you know, I'm off to the races again. And I think somewhere those, you know, I tried to do that, and then I found myself right back at the other substances. This is just my experience. And maybe some people may have a different experience, but I found myself right back at the alcohol. And so I kind of had to come to terms that that I can't really smoke weed, I can't drink, I can't do benzos, and, you know, we're just gonna see what happens. It was also important for me to try to listen to the professionals. Like, when I was at rehab and they suggested these things, they wanted me to get a sponsor, and they wanted me to go to a sober house, and they wanted me to, you know, put an effort forward, because the other times that I tried to get sober, it wasn't much of an effort. I went to meetings, but I did get a sponsor, but I wasn't taking my sponsor's suggestions, and so this time around, like, I was more willing to listen, and I went to a sober house. You know, they told me to, I remember on being on the phone with admissions from the sober house when I was in rehab, and he told me, I said I was a little nervous about being influenced by other people's behavior, when in reality, I don't know what that was about, really. I remember the person on the phone told me to, you know, stick with the winners. And that was important for me to hear at the time, because I knew about, like, the chaos that my life was when, you know, at the place at where I was in my life at the time.
So when you say you were worried about the influence of other people that might be at the sober living, you mean that they might take you down the wrong path?
Yeah, I think.
Is that because you didn't trust yourself?
Maybe. It's a little bit confusing to me. Looking back, like, why I asked that question. I think maybe I was, like, looking for, like, some victimization of maybe
somebody else's fault.
Yeah, like, maybe I was going to find myself with the wrong crew, and it was going to be the sober house's fault. And that was just my, you know, that was
Syracuse.
Yeah, all over again. But so when I got to the sober house, and I have a lot of thanks that, you know, the people that I was surrounded with were really.
What place did you go to?
I went to a treatment center, or a sober living treatment, sober living facility called Release Recovery.
Release Recovery, is that in Yorktown Heights, New York?
It's in Yorktown Heights in Westchester County, New York. You know, place changed my life. I think, you know, going to release and getting sober just totally gave me a different perspective on everything in my life, and allowed me to, a lot of things that we talked about were, you know, gratitude and hitting a bottom and building yourself back up, and, you know, consistency, and a lot of just good stuff that I learned.
So for people that don't know what it is to go to a sober living environment, can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I'd be happy to. I had to start from the bottom, because I came to this place. I couldn't really do chores. I'd never done chores in my life. I couldn't make my bed. I didn't know how to take care of myself. So starting with these small things at release that they preached, you know, one thing that one of the owner of the facility, he always says, messy bed, messy head. And so he's kind of saying that if you're don't have your bed made, you know, you it's probably more to that, you know, something's going on with you. So I learned that, like, making my bed, starting my day on a high note, and taking pride in my actions was really important for me. So You know, I was making my bed in the mornings. We would do a morning check-in where the community would gather in the living room and we'd read a reflection just to start the day. We'd talk about reset. It. And then we would all go kind of on our different paths because some people were doing different, you know, intensive outpatients through different programs. So we all weren't doing the clinical together.
Some people were working, I guess.
Some people were working, but we lived together. So it was a nice way to kind of, anybody that was around, we'd all gather. And, you know, there were times when I didn't want to do it. If I'm being completely honest, I'd be lying if I said that I made my bed perfectly every day and I was gung-ho about going to these things. But it taught me a lesson of, like, you know, that every day isn't going to be perfect and that, you know, it's just about sometimes just, you know, one step at a time and 1 hour at a time, 1 day at a time. And then, so yeah, I would do therapy and intensive IOP, which was like, you know, group therapy, which was very, very helpful for me. And then something that the sober release provided was after clinical, you know, we do, they wanted you to be productive. They didn't want you to stay in your bed, after clinical. So, you know, I would try my best to whatever that looked like for me. So, I mean, later on, like, I was applying for jobs and, you know, they have a tier system. So just like a little details about the facility that I was at.
Now, you went a little overboard with this whole sober living thing, didn't you?
I did.
Well, what'd you do?
I now work for them, if that's what you're saying.
That's what, right? I'm saying, yeah.
I work for Release Recovery. I expressed interest in working for Release when I was about 90 days sober. I knew that the staff there were just, they clearly had something that was desirable. They were sober. They were laughing. They were happy. And there I was, you know, newly sober. And I was struggling to find happiness. You know, I knew that, you know, I thought I had a good time with the drugs and the alcohol in college. And, but then, you know, something felt different about, you know, joy felt as a sober person. It's something I never experienced before, hadn't since, you know, that or those early ages when it became, you know, so just natural to me when I first picked up that first drink or drug. We played basketball a lot. We did a lot of service. And one thing, you know, that was taught to me was that you're, you know, out of self and into others and into God. And so just, you know, being of service, like doing things for other people without expecting anything in return, something that kind of another level that like built me back up a little bit, mm-hmm. Piece by piece.
And what kind of comfort or what kind of payoff is there working there and working with other people who are coming in basically in the same condition you were in, and now you're supposed to be the one who's got the answers? How does that feel? And are you comfortable with that?
It's weird. It's weird because I think it's not weird, but I tell myself that I just can't believe where I am and that, you know, I am being a power of example and I'm sober and I'm, you know, helping, trying my best to help these guys and teach them some stuff that I've learned that's helped me. And it's been a major gift in my life, to be a part of this, of Release and be sober and be able to give back to the program that was so freely given to me. You know, one thing I also really liked was that they told me, you know, the people that I surrounded myself with, whether it was in meetings or at the sober house or in an inpatient, you know, they believed in me before I believed in myself. They loved me before, you know, when I really didn't love myself. So being able to try to give that back and show these men that they're, you know, worthy of it and that it's going to get better. They just got to put in the footwork and that it's not going to happen overnight, but it will happen slowly. It's really a miracle to watch this stuff happen. It's a gift.
So if you had the opportunity now to talk to little Adam,
mm-hmm.
maybe 12, 13, 14 year old Adam, when you started playing around with mood altering things, mm-hmm. what kind of advice would you give young Adam knowing what you know now?
Yeah, I wish that I, you know, being a little bit less hard on myself and, I wish that I, you know, one thing that was a big part of my story that I didn't really talk about today was like, I did talk about a little, this idea of like not caring. I didn't care about my life, or I like to have fun. You know, I like to party and have a good time, but also at the same time, like, there were times when I just like didn't care about anything. Like, and then, you know, I've heard in the rooms, like, you know, called like the fuck it's. So I wish that however I would have been able to communicate that with my younger self, that, you know, that attitude isn't okay. That, you know, I should care, that, but it's hard. I don't know how I would have been able to communicate that with myself at that time, because I was really stuck in my ways. And I still, like, maybe, you know, thought that I knew what was best. And for me, even though I, you know, I was so young, so a little bit, yeah, that's what I would tell my younger self.
So I'm proud of you, and I'm happy for you, and I'm happy for the whole family. Thanks so much for being on Crosstalk. I'm going to talk to the camera now for a moment.
Okay.
Tell people my plea, my request, which is, first of all, we have a website, www.crosstalkofficial.com. We'd love you to subscribe and follow us. That's how we know we're doing things that are good. Smack the bell and tell us what we're doing that you like and what you don't like. Adam, thanks so much for being here. And thank you guys for watching. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.